Patrick Kraupa is a former member of the hacker collective Legion of Doom and a co-founder of Mindvox, one of the first ISPs in internet history. This is Patrick Kraupa. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tech.
Cool. So listen, I wanted to talk to you, Patrick, because you, the first thing that I had heard your name connected to was the Legion of Doom, this hacker group, and then Mindvox, of course. But how does one become part of a hacker group? Like, how does that even start? That seems so mysterious and like almost like a romantic idea. But like, how does that concretely happen?
Well, at the dawn of time back there, my introduction to computers was during the 1970s. My father was a physicist who was working at NCAR, which is the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And they had this really cool building designed by I.M. Pi, which was used by Woody Allen as a backdrop for filming Sleeper, which was a science fiction movie. And he took me there to hang out at his office, and they had one of the very first Crays that ever existed. And Cray is a supercomputer company that has sort of managed to stay alive across the decades by pivoting a lot of different times. But at the time, it was really impressive. You'd walk in, and there was this giant white room that was completely empty, and all of it was designed to basically cool down the Cray, which was like this tower-shaped object. I mean, it looks like sort of like a hexagon. Theirs was done up in red, and it looked like the early Silicon Graphics gear. It was very just aesthetically interesting. It's like, okay, what the fuck is that? And my father would like explain to me what the computer was doing, and the very first language I was exposed to was called Fortran 77, which is formula translation. It's a really old language. Yeah. It's been around forever, and they were using punched cards at the time to actually talk to the Cray and get it to do simulations on different scenarios. And that had sort of a lasting impact on me because, you know, technology and home computers and all of that was not ubiquitous back then as it is now. It was relatively rare. And in the 70s, I got an Apple II for my own use, and I started playing with it and taking it apart. And in the very early days, what was interesting was software piracy and getting involved with groups related to that. And what would happen is you'd get software, and really the most interesting thing about it, you get a new game, for instance, was the copy protection. What are they doing to try to prevent you from copying this? And it was like, okay, so you learn how to boot trace, which is like how the program is loading. You learn about NMI, which is non-maskable interrupt. You can have a hardware switch that basically prevents the software from trying to control the computer, all these different things. And basically you communicated through these things called bulletin board systems, which are very, very similar to forums that are online right now, and social networks, which became the evolution of BBS systems. And there were a couple of guys named Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss who wrote the first BBS. And these gradually spread across the landscape. And
so what is BBS?
Bulletin board system.
Oh,
that's
okay,
what it was
okay.
called back
gotcha.
Then. And essentially you can think of them as very simple forums. It was basically you could post messages and interact with other people. And the way that people were running them at the time, there was no public internet access. They would just connect a computer to the phone lines, and you'd dial in, and people basically took turns. And like one person would sign in, and then another person would sign in after they'd left, and you can interact with one another. And that was like, okay, so having the computer led to having interest in, you know, taking apart the software and learning how it worked, which led to communicating with other people online, which led to my very first phone bill of like $800, which made my mom completely freak out. It's just like, okay, what the fuck is this? And the reason for that is because you're dialing all over the planet and there is no internet where you just connect things. You had to physically dial all these long distance numbers. It's like, okay, so what, how does the phone system work exactly? That was sort of the inception of getting really interested in that. And during the late 70s and early 80s, the first very large scale publicly accessible network was the phone system back in those days, and that was Bell, and that became AT&T, and they actually are the entity that wrote Unix. And Unix still forms the backbone for the entire internet at this point. I mean, it's different flavors of it. Servers are running Linux and OpenBSD and whatever use case you may have. But anyway, so I became interested in how the phone company works. And a lot of it at the time was security through obscurity, as in if you got these manuals and you got access to them and you knew these phone numbers to call and were able to interact with people or log in, then everyone just assumed that you belong there, because otherwise, why are you calling up and why do you know all these different acronyms and all this jargon? And you could socially engineer a lot of access, and you could sort of gain control of the phone system. And one of the very obvious side effects and benefits of that was the ability to essentially, bring your phone bill down to zero, because the network isn't costing them anything. It doesn't actually charge any money to connect point A to point B. And that's where phone phreaking came in. And phone freaking was people who were essentially interested in hacking the phone company's computer systems. And in the olden days, it was using in-band signaling. The first electronic switching systems didn't start to spin up until, by the early 80s, they were in broad use. I don't recall whether in the late 70s they were being used widely or just testing. But what changed was it went to out-of-band signaling. With the old phone system, with in-band signaling, that meant you could drop control tones into the conversation that was taking place. In that case, it was 2600 hertz. That was the magical tone which would trunk a phone line, and then you needed a couple of extra keys on your keyboard, which is like, KPST, key pulse forward, start, and essentially you were an operator. You had the power to do anything that any other operator with their network did, and you could route yourself all over the world.
So basically, just so I got this here, basically the 2600 hertz, which I believe there's like a hacking magazine, 2600, I'm assuming that's named after that frequency.
Correct.
Okay. And you're creating, like, I heard some people used to do this. I don't know if it's the same thing with like the whistle you got in the Captain Crunch cereal boxes.
That
it would blow that whistle.
That.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It would connect you, and you could be an operator on the phone lines. That is, how old were you when you were doing this?
I was when I started doing all these things. I mean, the software exploration that began when I was about 8 years old, 9 years old, and when I really got the power and started to understand how things were working, I was about 12 or 13, because my voice changed pretty early.
Yeah.
And when you're on the phone, it's very hard to tell if you're a grown-up who's in his 30s or if you're a 13-year-old kid if you have a deep voice. That was an interesting sort of introduction to social engineering and getting different entities to do whatever it is that you needed for them to do. And
crazy.
It was very interesting because so the progression was basically from, okay, this is the Apple in front of me, which was the Apple II computer. Here's the software. Here's taking apart the software. Here's getting online to sort of find your peer group, and gradually moving through the phone company's computer systems to figure out how to, you know, get rid of those $800 a month phone bills because there is no internet and you have to somehow connect together, to gaining control over the largest network at the time, which was the Bell system and AT&T, that morphed into. So that was the progression from, you know, software hacking to phone phreaking to just hacking and taking apart different computer systems. And so the way these groups would form is a group of people would consistently share information that was of high quality. And then you'd start talking with one another, you'd get each other's phone numbers, and you would basically form these cliques, and you'd work together on different projects. And the Legion of Doom was actually formed after something called the Knights of Shadow fell apart. And it's always these big, epic, scary names. I mean, nobody was the Super Friends. It was the Legion of Doom.
Yeah.
It wasn't, because, I mean, most of the people who were very obsessed with this world and fell into it, well, a lot of people had interesting backgrounds and, you know, their reasons for becoming obsessed with this technology at the time. And, you know, the term sociopath and teenage boy are frequently interchangeable because you haven't really learned the boundaries of reality. And, you know, back then at that time, none of the laws that exist right now were really in effect. Nobody knew what any of it was. It was this brand new world. And it was really interesting because it felt like at the time, like you were literally this character that fell into like this superhero novel or something. I mean, it's like I have the power to intercept people's phone calls. I have the power to listen to what anybody is saying on the phone. And you begin to understand a lot of things you've been told are complete bullshit because the phone company always claimed, hey, we can't do that. Yeah, you can, because you have commands in your software that allow it. It's monitoring for line quality, except you're just listening to people's phone conversations. Of course you can do that. And so it was this growing movement, which at the very beginning was comprised of a couple of hundred kids. Then it became a couple thousand, and it gradually grew. And During the 80s, there were a collection of raids on the participants of these different subcultural niches, and usually that was because some individual sort of started causing problems, and you know perhaps crossed the boundary over into black hat hacking, but by which I mean to say they were getting some sort of personal gain out of it. It was beyond exploration, or they were trying to damage something. And there was something called Operation Sun Devil, which was like a collection of well-orchestrated witch hunts where they sort of kicked in the doors of a lot of different people and the good times ended. And that was... pardon me, that was essentially the birth of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where a couple of people like Mitch Kapoor, who was the author of Lotus 1-2-3, which was the first spreadsheet that existed, and that which made the Apple II computer really viable for business. And then there was John Perry Barlow was part of that, and John Gilmore, who was one of the first employees. The whole dialogue about hacking and freedom of speech sort of started taking shape. And all of this coming together was sort of the backdrop for when I launched MindVox with my friend Bruce Fancher. And you know, Bruce was in the Legion of Doom with me. And the way that the Mind Box actually started is we were hanging out and we were copying Amiga software, which was another computer platform at the time, and we were copying video games, and we went like, hey, you know, it would be cool to put this thing online. So why don't we get a system and put it up? And we did that, and we started Phantom Access Technologies, which was named after a hacking program that I had written in my teens. And that was sort of the parent name for the company, and that was 1991. And I believe we were finally incorporated around Christmas, and then very early 1992, we went online, we registered a domain name, which at that time was phantom.com, which is still our domain name, and you know, mindblocks.com was registered subsequent to that, but anyway, basically it was like, okay, let's put up this system, which really had nothing to do with being a business decision or seeing a market opening. We didn't have any of those thoughts. It was more like we want to do this and we need to find a way to subsidize what all of this crap is costing us, because there's all this hardware, there are these phone lines, and so we started looking people into the system, and we put together some software that allowed them to communicate, like the BBSs we've been using up until that point in time. And so that was 1992. And all of these energies kind of collided together, and we became the first internet access provider in New York City and in New York available to the public. We were, I believe, the third in the United States. The first two were Barry Schein had the World, which was in Massachusetts, and Bob Rieger had a system called Netcom in California. And those are the first three publicly accessible internet providers in the United States.
Yeah.
And
let me just ask you something really quick. So this was after all the, like, the big raids happened on a lot of these more sort of playful exploratory hacker groups, but were you, like you said, you listen in on phone calls and stuff like that. Like, I imagine, especially like teenagers, young people in general, given that power, would abuse the shit out of it. Like, there's no way that, like, it there had to have been some shenanigans going on that, like, I don't know the details, so I can't, like, make a judgment on whether or not any of the raids were justified, but, like, certainly teenagers should not be able to listen in on random people's phone calls, right? Like, did you guys ever listen to, like, some just, like, freaky, like, or high-level, high-power people, or was it mostly just, like, you know, someone calling their son at college or something like that? Like, could you target individual people? Like, what, can you give some insight there? I'm curious about the phone calls. Like,
okay. Well, it was essentially all of the above. So one of them is like, okay, what does your girlfriend really have to say about you when she's talking with her friends? Okay. That everyone had to check that one off the list. And there's, What are people saying that you see on TV? You know, what does this person say to that person? And there's, like, you know, finding people's phone numbers. And, of course, one of the most popular phone numbers to find at the time was the Woz, because that was Steve Wozniak, and he was the magical man who actually made the Apple, while, you know, Steve Jobs is the marketing genius that made it, you know, get light up planet Earth and turn into, you know, what it is right now, which is the world's largest company. And so you'd call up the Woz, and it's like he was expecting it by that point in time, and he'd talk to you, and you could interact with all these different people. And we did actually participate in a lot of different pranks, and, you know, calling people up, and just, you know, seeing how they would respond, or, you know, seeing what they actually had to say. So, okay, this is a public figure and they're saying, you know, these things in public. What do they have to say in private? And that was, it was just curiosity.
NSA level, like, power right there. Did you ever, like, look up, like, politicians? Like, okay, what's this person saying behind closed doors?
We did at different points in time, and some of those conversations were very interesting, and many of them were extremely insulated, because what you would find out is, like, okay, how does this person actually talk? And the answer is, okay, they walk out into, like, their lobby of their office, and they have a quote-unquote public payphone, which is not public. It's, I mean, you can't really access it, and that's how they talk. The reason for that being is extremely difficult to get a court order to, you know, monitor a public phone, whereas it may be very easy to monitor their individual phones and their individual records. And back then, you know, if you had a mobile phone, that meant you had a suitcase and a handset connected to it, and eventually those kind of, like, shrunk down into, you know, these brick-sized devices. And really, I think Motorola and the StarTAC, those were the first iterations of what would resemble current mobile phones, and that didn't arrive until the late 90s, really. And, I mean, BlackBerry, of course. But, you just had an insane amount of information at your disposal. When you're a teenage kid, you don't really have a lot of insight on what all of that would mean. But the one thing that it left me with, and a lot of people, is just, you know what? All of reality is comprised of half-truths, lies, and a lot of bullshit. It's just like, this is the story or the narrative that's being sold, but all of reality is actually manipulated. It's not real. It's just another show. And that sort of impacted pretty hard at that time, because you could sort of, like, look behind the magic curtain and figure out that what people presented themselves as and what they represented might not be who they really are.
What was the most, like, stark contrast, like, who did you who's I don't know if there are, like, legal issues in talking about it, but, like, whose phone were some of you guys able to, like, tap, where they presented one public face and their private face was just completely different?
The answer to that would be individuals who are involved in politics, and individuals who are involved in different events that had spun litigation, and were different cases that were happening at the time that were really important or interesting. And without naming those individuals, since many of them are still around right now and actively engaged in the same thing, was a very large dichotomy between what was being sold to you and the narrative that was presented and what their actual thoughts and beliefs might be. And it was like, okay, everybody is just acting and all of this is a script, and it produces a lot of cynicism and lack of faith in people's intentions and who they claim to be. And on the flip side, on the obverse of that, there were people who were just exactly what they portrayed themselves as being, like, you know, Steve Wozniak is one example that comes to mind, because, you know, he literally was, you know, this magic man at that time who made this computer all by himself. And he did. He invented the computer. He invented the disk drive, the 5.25 inch drive. He invented the operating system. It's just like, okay, Steve, write down and just sit down and do all this, write this code, design all these things. And he was ridiculously friendly and receptive, and he just loved what he was doing. So there were, you know, very bright counterpoints to those moments in time. But It basically changed after Operation Sun Devil, in the sense that the government kind of like woke up, and even when they did not have any cases to bring against people, which means they would just, okay, they'll show up, they'll kick in your door, they'll steal all your shit, they'll take away your computer, they stole, you know, people's cassette tapes, you know, back in the day, because it's, you know, you could store data on those. They basically showed up at your house and robbed you, and they took away all your stuff, and then no charges were forthcoming. And what would happen is, you know, 7 years later, after the statute of limitations had expired, you'd get back these big cardboard boxes filled up with all your crap, and various states are being broken, and it's like, okay, that was it. They basically really went after a couple of individuals very, very hard. And the rest of it was sort of sending a message that the government is alive and well and aware of you guys doing what you're doing, and we'd like for you to stop. The birth of the public internet was unexpected, and it was interesting because, you know, the internet was initially a project of, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and their goal was to create a fully decentralized network with no single point of authority. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with all this. You're
right.
You know, with your background, and much to their regret, ever since, I mean, they succeeded. So what would happen is, like, okay, we put up MindVox, and we're in New York City, and a lot of the trendier people who were on the edge, which at that time was like, reality hackers, had become Mondo 2000, which was a magazine that was put together by Allison Kennedy and Are You Serious in California. And Wired did not exist at the time. They were just starting to publish their very first issues. And I believe that Louis Rossetto and the other founder had modeled it after something called The Electric Pencil, which was published in Amsterdam. But anyway, it was sort of like the edge. And all of these people started paying attention to it. And what would happen every fall is, like, people would make jokes about the whole internet is going to get fucked up, and it's like all these people are going to pour into it because school will start, and all of these kids are going to get assigned email addresses, and of course they're the only ones who had access to the early internet because you got access at school. And it's like they're going to show up on the news groups and all the different forums, and it's all the newbies are going to show up and ruin everything. And it was just entertaining because it seemed to me like a bunch of cranky old men getting upset that, you know, whatever's happening. But
right. But is this, does, you know, this refer to the concept of what eventually became like the eternal September?
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit?
The eternal September is the process of a lot of new people sort of entering the space that you're in, who are not familiar with any of the culture or sort of the history that really led up to the moment in time that they arrive. Because usually they don't care. It's like, okay, well, here's your email address. You've been assigned to school, and here's your access to the Usenet, and here's your access to, you know, you can tell that this predates SSH, and, you know, it predates WWW because it had not yet been invented. It was, you would tell that from system to system. You'd open a connection off a terminal or a command line in Unix or whatever. And it was just like the influx of complete novices who would show up and sort of increase the noise to content ratio on everything. That would be a summary of basically that.
Okay, and then eventually it became the concept of eternal September. Is like, okay, it wasn't just the kids coming in September and they would sign up and they would have access to Usenet, and to the internet, and you know, slowly over the course of the year, acclimate to the culture. Only for a fresh round of recruits. Eventually, the September became eternal in the sense that now it's just everybody has access to the internet, and it's not just people who are ushered in through the school system. It's anyone, and they don't spend a year trying to get acclimated to the culture. It's sort of just like a free for all. But that seems kind of like a sort of loss of, I don't know if you'd say it's like a loss of innocence, but it's a loss of a certain beauty of the internet, at least in my mind. I don't know if you share the same feelings about it.
I do. That was sort of like the transition from where it shifted out of being sort of like this secret space that was shared by, you know, in the beginning, hundreds and thousands, tens of thousands of people. And it's just like everybody and their grandmother has got to get on the internet immediately. And that was sort of the deluge. And the early adopters were, you know, a lot of the drug culture in California and San Francisco in particular. And a lot of the, you know, libertarian individuals who were always interested in technology and, a lot of the counterculture, actually, because, you know, Abby Hoffman from the Yippies had started something which predates 2600 Magazine, which you mentioned. 2600 was started by Eric Corley, who I think has legally changed his name to Emmanuel Goldstein, you know, that the man from 1984 novels. And, you know, TAP is what it was called. It was a technological assistance program, and it was essentially countercultural 60s individuals who were publishing a hard copy newsletter about how to, you know, essentially fuck shit up and take over the phone system. And that was their interest. And so it was all these different, very colorful groups of eccentric individuals who comprised the initial liftoff. And then everybody poured in because Wired became ridiculously mainstream and successful, which was their goal. And Mondo 2000, which was the other magazine competing with Wired, they sort of ceased to exist and ceased publishing because their goal was not to be a professional, you know, well-funded organization that generated revenue for their shareholders. Their goal was to have a lot of fun and have a good time. And they right. did until it, you know, wasn't worthwhile anymore. But that was the tipping point, because that was, for me, that was being in New York City in the early 90s. And it's just like, okay, everybody is pouring into this thing. I mean, we're growing at a rate of like 100% every month. And it's just was completely crazy.
And you guys were very, also, I mean, it should be mentioned, you were not like just some company, like you were very well known, you were covered in mainstream media, and there was a certain hype around you guys. I think that's pretty fair to say, right?
Yeah, I wrote kind of like this manifesto called Voices in My Head, which was sharing my thoughts about sort of the decade that predated the launch of Mindvox and what led up to it. And so essentially, yeah, I mean, there was just like a tremendous amount of hype around what we were doing and who all of us were, who our backgrounds were, and the individuals who we employed. I mean, I think at the, you know, the initial phases of Mindvox, I mean, there was myself, there was Bruce, we were from, you know, LOD, and there was Fiber Optic, who was in both LOD and MOD, which was, you know, Legion of Doom and Masters of Deception. That was the rival gang of LOD, and it all kind of devolved into arguments with a couple of individuals. But anyway, he was facing felony charges at the time, and eventually, very unfortunately, wound up being turned into an example and had to, I I think he served about a year in prison, and we had Len Rose, who was Terminus. You know, Len had just gotten out of prison. He was literally living at a halfway house, you know, working with us, and he was, you know, the online system security guy and network administrator. And these were our friends, and they were just like people in the hacker subculture who were really good at what they were doing, which enabled us to provide the services that we were and to light all this up, which was a lot harder back then than right now. And it had this whole kind of vibe, which was like a touchstone for a lot of interesting people, and it lit up, and it basically got bigger and bigger very fast.
It's one of the things that, and I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but one of the things that is so, it boggles my mind, the fact that while you guys were growing this company and you were like managing, these are not trivial tasks, and yet at the same time, correct me if I'm wrong, but during this time you were doing heroin. And, like, obviously you've got off of it and all that is behind you, but, like, how the fuck do you manage that, dude? Like, how are you able to do those things? Like, when I picture someone doing heroin, I picture, I don't picture someone getting anything done. Certainly not someone in charge of a company.
Well, I was what you'd call a high-functioning addict, and there are actually a surprisingly large number of those. When you're on heroin, all it means is that you're extraordinarily calm pretty much all the time. So it's actually quite simple to get things done, because you're not experiencing stress, you're not experiencing all this emotional turmoil that you might otherwise have. It's very steadying and very nice. And, you know,
sounds good so far.
I'm not suggesting anyone goes and does it. It's a really nice headspace. I mean, to sum it all up, when people ask, well, what is it that you want out of life? The answer would be, I'd like to feel exactly like this forever. That's it. That's all I want. You have contentment, you have peace, you feel good. And so that wasn't so hard. I mean, my whole life, like my personal life, was a complete wreck. And that was true of multiple individuals within Mindbox. That's just not only myself, and it's not necessarily information that everyone has chosen to share about themselves, but that was okay. The part where it sort of got out of control is where you add cocaine into the mix, and I was doing speedballs, which is you mix together heroin and cocaine, and at that point it's very hard to remain high functioning. At that point it's like, okay, I 2 weeks just vanished, and you know, you repeat that over and over again, and you sort of start to disintegrate and fall apart, which is what happened to me. But you know, heroin.
Was not the problem, is what you're saying.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, heroin was the super glue that allowed me to keep going and just like not worry about all my personal issues and all the events that were happening in my life necessarily, and just focus on what I wanted to focus on. It's like, okay, I can think. All the noise in my head has stopped.
But you're saying this in a very calm tone and a very reasonable tone, and I'm almost like, I can almost believe what you're saying, but I mean, heroin, was that really a super glue? I mean, looking back, if you had not been doing anything at all, if you just got up in the morning, had a cup of coffee, you know, like, would that not have, you know, maybe meditated or something like that, would that not have been just as good?
It's, you know, from using the lens of just having an objective viewpoint into all of that, yeah, of course. And if that's what I had been doing, then, you know, at this point in time, we'd all be billionaires and everything would have played out a little bit differently. And ultimately, the whole thing wouldn't have burst into flames and become this epic sort of disaster. Undoubtedly. And I had an endless amount of psychiatrists and therapists and people supporting me who provided the same insight, essentially, at the time. It's just, it was very difficult to stop. Heroin is something that I started doing when I was very young. I was about 14 years old. I had, you know, one of those toxic childhoods that's so popular. And I just grew up in an area where that was on every street corner and every stoop. It was all over the place. It was very accessible. And it had been sort of part of my life for a long time by the time Mindvox had started, but it wasn't really a problem. And at the point where I just started making a lot of money, it became a bigger and bigger problem that escalated. But at no time would I say that heroin was the thing that sort of destroyed my life. I mean, at that point in time, it sort of enabled my life. It's really strange, because I mean, looking at it in retrospect, had I not been on heroin and not been addicted, then everything would have played out a bit differently, because I would have had a much greater locus of control than I did back then. Things wouldn't have sort of devolved into the train wreck that they did. And, that would be cool. But at the same time, I was struggling with a lot of things I wasn't really emotionally or psychologically equipped to deal with, because I was a kid. And that I was extremely grateful for that super glue, because it's just like, you know, what do I want? I just want the pain to stop. And that worked. That did it. And what were computers and technology and all these different things I became obsessed with? The first drug I remember is reading. It's just like, okay, this is cool. I can read these words and escape. I get out of my situation. I'm someplace completely different. And thoughts are things. And, you know, computers amplified that potential. And it was it was all very interrelated. And, you know, I was experimenting with just attaching molecules to my receptors, you know, reality hacking, which is not very unique. I mean, there's a large contingent of individuals who were responsible for the entire computer industry lighting up, who were quite familiar with drugs. Some of them used hard drugs. The vast majority used psychedelics. And, you know, now over here in 2020, when I look at that, it's like we've got the opioid epidemic, which is, of course, brought to you by Big Pharma, because they're the world's largest drug dealer. Right. And you've got, you know, psychedelics are being mainstreamed for the first time in history. You've got MDMAs in phase 3 clinical trials, thanks to, you know, Rick Doblin and MAPS. You've got psilocybin, I believe, is in phase 1 or 2 for treatment-resistant depression. All these molecules that were demonized are now being accepted as having a lot of potential benefits, both therapeutically and in the case of Silicon Valley and the whole inceptions of the internet, creatively. It's like, you know, think outside the box. How do you do that? I don't know. Drop some LSD and you certainly will get out of the box. There's no more box. There's no more doorway.
You might not be in where you want to be, but you will definitely be outside of whatever box you were in. Yeah.
Yeah, you will. And as you're gliding down and reintegrating, then your mind cross-connects thoughts and ideas and information in novel ways that you may have been unable to access prior to that. There's a lot of very early internet pioneers who became quite vocal about their enthusiasm for psychedelic drugs as they reach the point of becoming worth, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, and they don't care anymore. It's just like, you know, it's not like someone's going to fire me because I said that I do a lot of psychedelics.
Right. Yeah. If anything, they'll be like, oh, you're an eccentric genius, you know, like
yeah,
when Steve Jobs said,
yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah,
my
that's true. That, you know, Jobs did. It's that, you know, LSD is one of the most important things I ever did in my life. John Gilmore, who's, again, one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and one of the very first employees of Sun Microsystems, which made the hardware that actually made the internet work back then. I mean, he was a big proponent of Burning Man, and he would show up and get himself photographed and talk about it. It's not very isolated, is what I'm saying. I mean, creativity, psychedelic drugs, technology had always sort of interlocked since the very early days.
But what's weird about that is there are other creative industries out there. Like, I assume that some people in the movie industry are doing psychedelics, but it's not as, like, notorious as, like, you know, as it is in Silicon Valley. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, what extra wrinkle is technology providing to this mix? Because it is creativity, but it's also like this weird cerebral, I don't know how to put it, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, what is it about technology?
It's interesting, but it's like, for me, technology has always been sort of an obsession. It's okay, you have OCD. What does that mean? Well, it's a great gift if you allow it to go into places where you steer it. It just means you keep going where other people quit. And with technology in particular, there's the actual potential to sort of apply all of these different thoughts and make shit happen. If I was going to point out like a single specific intersection point which kind of captured all of these different elements, for me anyway, it would be oddly enough, or not oddly enough, you know, William Gibson was for the most part not very technologically literate at the time. He wrote a novel called Neuromancer, and that came out in 1984. And there was actually like a short story before that by Werner Binge called True Names. But essentially, Neuromancer was a novel where the primary protagonist was an anti-hero who was a black hat hacker that happened to be a drug addict. I was like, okay, you just lit up every single fucking thing that comprises my entire life and suspended it within this framework of mythology. It was like, holy shit, you're the Joseph Campbell of cyberspace. And, what is technology doing? I mean, what is our brain? I mean, it's the greatest supercomputer that's ever been invented. Everybody has one floating around inside their skull. Everything that you think that you like or makes you happy really is an illusion, because the only thing anybody gives a shit about is dopamine and serotonin. Those are the only things that your brain really likes. I mean, you know, if you think you accomplish this thing or you get into this relationship or buy that house or have that job, all these things will make you happy. Maybe they will for a while. Who knows? It's dependent on you. But really, the only thing that you care about is dopamine and serotonin. That's it. That's the program. And with computer systems and psychedelics, I mean, it becomes fascinating because you start sort of playing with transhumanism, becoming more than we are, evolving to the next level. I mean, if you look at the very early stuff that came out, for instance, VPL Labs and Jerome Lanier, it's silly, because if you're looking and reading at what they're saying in the late 80s, early 90s, it's just like, complete fucking nonsense. The technology does not exist for any of this. I mean, your entire company there is ultimately, I mean, I think VPL was bought out by Sun Microsystems, you know, before they got acquired by Larry Ellison and Oracle, and they produced almost nothing functional because it wasn't possible. But
what were they trying to do?
They were trying to create virtual reality where you'd get total immersion in this alternate space. And when I show up at, oddly enough, psychedelics conferences in the, right now, and 6 months ago, 12 months ago, there's this entire thing called cyberdelics. What are cyberdelics? And for me, I mean, you're familiar with all of this. You could perhaps share your own insights, but for me, what was fascinating is, you know, wait a minute, it's 2019, 2020. I've heard this shit before, 30 years ago. Nothing has changed. It's exactly the same. And what it amounts to is, hey, we're all going to do a lot of psychedelic drugs and play with our computers. And then eventually we'll just fall into our computers. And it's, that seems to be the recurring sort of obsession amongst a lot of people. It's just, we're going to become superhuman or godlike entities. We're going to attain the singularity. We're going to share our feelings, our thoughts, our emotions, and just transcend what it means to be human. That seems to be a very basic kind of innate human drive or desire. And a lot of people get really lit up on that. And it's a very romantic and powerful kind of motivational force. It's creativity, it's passion, it's the love of what you're doing, and sort of the wonder and the awe of where all of this can go. Because, you know, you don't have to believe in any fucking thing if you take psychedelics. You can believe in nothing. Just attach the molecule to your receptors. You don't have to think about spirituality or the divine. You just experience it for yourself. And if you're experiencing all this while you're surrounded by a bunch of computer gear, it all kind of cross connects and you pull it together and cool things happen. It's it's very, you know, common and ubiquitous amongst people who are playing with technology and sort of doing so at the very highest levels where they're really creative and, you know, that thinking outside the box is putting it mildly, or evolving something or creating something brand new. Cool things happen.
Do you think Elon Musk takes psychedelics?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that he smokes high sativa content weed. I mean, I think
apparently, yes.
Knows that.
Yes, yeah.
The SEC and his shareholders would prefer if you shut the fuck up on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I love Elon Musk. He's awesome. And Tesla is a great company. And SpaceX. And it's just, you know, when does he have a life? It just, he works 48 hours a day, and then he's a very colorful individual, and I greatly appreciate his work.
Well, one of the things I was going to say when you were talking about the transhumanism and like this desire to be like godlike and the singularity, I agree that it is like an innate human drive, but it's in some ways, and I'm not saying we'll never get there, but in some ways, it is an innate human drive in the same sense that like creating a Tower of Babel is, like this desire to conquer nature. And there's part of me that one of the things this pandemic has revealed, it sort of slipped the mask of civilization off just a little bit to say like, okay, like we really are ultimately ants on a spinning ball hurtling through space. Like we're not as in charge as we think we are. And you know, things like climate change in the future, like nature reasserting itself almost, like we have a long way to go, I think, before like mastering nature or truly becoming godlike in any way. Like they always say, nature can only be commanded by obeying it, which is very true. Like you can't skip outside like the laws of nature. You're ultimately, you know, if you have like a pulley system that you can just pull a string and it lifts like a giant ship out of the water, like you're not conquering gravity, you're just sort of manipulating it. So I don't know if we're ever gonna like truly escape ourselves. And I think as much as I hope we get to some point where we can sort of experience like you know, if there was a way of transplanting our consciousness in like a computer and letting it live forever, like great, that would be a scientific project like worth achieving. But it almost when you were talking about escapism earlier and this like obsession, like it almost seems like that's a lot of the driving force behind technologists' like desire to achieve that goal. And I get sometimes a vibe of like, oh, like humans are shit, like humans are just, we're just dumb apes, and like, yeah, we are, but like you see what I'm saying? Like, we shouldn't like ridicule ourselves either, you know, or necessarily try to escape ourselves. I don't know. That's kind of a rambling dissertation.
I get what you're saying. I mean, it's like, well, we are apes. We're not dumb apes. We're smart apes. We're probably the apes that ate the indigenous psychoactive substances that were around us and started thinking different than the other apes and evolved.
Right, yeah.
With that one fantasy being the singularity where, okay, we've cast off all limitations of what it means to be human. We can cure all diseases, including death. There is equality and plenty for everybody, you know, et cetera. There's the other reality that's opposing that, which is where, I mean, you have a computer science background. You're very familiar with a lot of the topics I'm touching upon. And yeah, the other big thing opposing the singularity would be artificial intelligence. I mean, when you get to the very core of the question, is it really a great idea to be busy creating something which is orders of magnitude smarter than we are? And yeah. The answer to that is, well, has nobody watched Terminator? What if the thing that it gets created is comes to the conclusion the biggest problem with planet Earth are those ape-like creatures who have evolved and are busy fucking shit up, so let's take everything over and get rid of them. So, I mean, and oddly enough, that's not just like a weird meme that's, you know, by conspiracy nuts on 4chan or Infinite Chan or wherever. I mean, these are the same issues that Stephen Hawking articulated while he was alive, and you know, Elon Musk, who you just mentioned, is also spoken about. I mean, that's there's a lot of forces we're setting into play without really understanding the consequences. And I think the fundamental reason for that is there isn't anybody I know who does anything that has ever asked themselves the question, should I be doing this? The question is always, well, how can I do this more effectively and faster and make it better? And nobody asks themselves the question, should I? It's just like, how do I do it better? The people who are asking, should anyone be doing this, tend to be, you know, committees and groups and, you know, looking at whatever happened 5 to 10 years after the fact. Like, yeah, should people be doing that? Well, who the fuck knows, but they are. They're really busy trying to do it, which goes back to what you mentioned. We're really smart apes. I mean, we play with our minds and we attempt to push the boundaries of what is possible. And, you know, in terms of manipulating the bodies that we live within and, you know, transhumanism, all of that is actually moving forward pretty rapidly. I mean, that all of these different fields of technology are sort of intersecting together, and it's becoming very interesting what could happen in the near term future. And at the same time, as you pointed out, the whole backdrop of what's happening on planet Earth and with COVID is a good demonstration that I guess man plans, God laughs, and shit happens.
Right. Well, speaking of shit happens, what happened with MindVox? Well, you said it was a train wreck. What exactly went down?
Well, what happened was just that there weren't any grown-ups present who had any power to sort of like change the course, I guess, mm-hmm. is what it would amount to. It was myself and Bruce who had started it, and I was I think 22, and I think Bruce was 20 at the time. I mean, that's basically that was just the evolution of our teenage years and moving forward. And I was having significant drug related issues, and my ability to function had declined, and it's just all the entire subculture and .com was starting, and there were all these different opportunities that grown-ups, people who were coming from a business background and wanted to monetize all this, saw. And I think you asked that question initially. It's like, what do you view as the ending of the golden age? And that was basically it. It was the September that never ended and .com beginning. And that's when the whole world kind of poured in, and the business world poured in, and their interests are, of course, just how best to monetize everything. And that kicked off the environment that we have today. And what happened with MindVox was actually not that eventful in the end. The entire user base and everything was acquired by another company. We held on to all the intellectual property. I mean, we still own all the domains. We own the software. There's always talk of like, okay, we'll just put it back up as a historical exhibit, or we'll do something with it. we haven't done that yet, but all of it is intact, and it's just kind of like sitting there. I mean, I can spin it up in a VM. There's a system. And so we actually went offline to the public in the late 90s. I believe 1997, 98 is when we access for most normal users, and just kept a couple of mailing lists running, which kind of continued in perpetuity. And that was it. I mean, the user base got acquired, and we all went about our lives. That was very sort of anticlimactic. It was not what we had in mind when none of it was what we had in mind when we started it. When we started, we were just going to build this system to hang out in with our friends. So I had, when you first get past the denial stage and you get to the point of, okay, I have a drug problem and I'd like to detox, I'd like to stop this. I mean, I tried literally every methodology, every paradigm that existed like back then, the 90s, which is actually remarkably similar to what we've got right now. Very little has changed. So there's opioid substitution therapy, there are tapers, there's ultra rapid opioid detox. I tried all of those. I tried this thing called a TENS unit, which is like electronic acupuncture. And there was a guy called Dr. Richard Resnick, who was at Columbia at the time, who was actually a really, really nice guy. And you go into his office and there'd be like a signed photo of Pete Townsend, and there's Eric Clapton. He would not mount Keith. Basically, he would not mount Keith Richards' photograph. That wasn't happening. But he basically was kind of like whatever. He would give you different materials to try, and I was on the very early clinical trials for buprenorphine, which they were trying to make bioavailable sublingually, and they succeeded with that, and it became Subutex and Suboxone, and anyway, it was electronic acupuncture. Did not work for me, but it was really hot at the time. And so I remembered Ibogaine and hearing about it during the TAP meetings on the Lower East Side, because that's sort of where knowledge of Ibogaine began. This guy named Howard Lotsoff in the 1960s mentioned that, oh, hey, if you're strung out, you take this psychedelic drug, when you come back down to Earth and you reintegrate, you're not strung out anymore. Like, okay, wow, that's interesting. And so they had this lady named Deborah Mash had started clinical trials within the U.S., and the FDA actually greenlighted them and approved it during the 90s, which is a fucking miracle because it was a psychedelic drug. It's the 1990s, and they said, okay. And then it ran out of funding because NIDA refused to, you know, give it any further money. But whatever the case, it worked for me. I went to this island in the West Indies called St. Kitts. And, well, at the time I was on about 200 mg of methadone, then about a gram and a half to 2 grams a day of heroin, which is a pretty... Well, that's a pretty heavy habit for someone who doesn't have tolerance. It's enough to kill probably, like, I don't know, a dozen, 15 people if you don't have tolerance. But really, back then it was high. Today, that would be average or low, because now you've got fentanyls, which are far, far more addictive and powerful than heroin. I mean, everything's fucking fentanyl. People show up for like detox. I'm addicted to heroin. No, you're not. You think you're buying heroin, but there isn't any left. You're actually addicted to fentanyl. Your addiction is enormous. So it's only, you know, that would be a very low baseline at this point. I mean, in 2020, it's far worse. But so when I first took Ibogaine, you have to be in the process of withdrawal. And what withdrawal is like is basically pain, because there's an absence of endorphins. You aren't producing any because your body is used to the continuous exogenous administration of other molecules. And so I'm sweating, I'm shaking. It feels like my spine is being smashed in a vise. It's just pain. It's not fun. And then you take Ibogaine, and within 30 to about 45 minutes, you have like this feeling of warmth, and it's starting in my solar plexus. And then it's kind of like coiling up my spine, and all of the pain is just letting go. And that was probably the closest thing in my life I have ever experienced that would count as a miracle, because based upon everything that we know, this is fucking impossible. This cannot happen. I have been through detox so many times, and it's never anything except pain. It sucks. And this is kind of just like, okay, that was a bad dream. It faded away. It's gone. And then you're really busy for the next 6 to 8 hours because you're tripping. So that was Ibogaine. So in short, Ibogaine is an extraordinarily effective detox for polysubstance abuse disorders. It will absolutely reset physical dependence upon pretty much everything except for benzodiazepines, because it's an inverse agonist at GABA receptors. Doesn't work for benzos. So it's like Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, that whole class of drugs that does nothing. But everything else, it works. It's extremely effective. And, you know, over here in 2020, we still don't understand what the mechanism of action is. We don't know why it works, but it sure does. So that's...
Have there been any clinical studies of this?
No, that's one of the things that, like, an assortment of different companies I'm involved with are, attempting to kickstart, which is there have only been small small groups of individuals run through it. And I mean, if you look up on PubMed, for instance, there are a plethora of papers which appear in peer-reviewed medical journals attesting its efficacy in, you know, interrupting polysubstance abuse disorders. Now, the main thing would be to get a clinical trial going in a preferably a G7 nation and move onwards with medicalizing Ibogaine. And that appears to be in the process of happening because, you know, over here in 2020, psychedelics are being mainstream and the whole world environment has changed considerably. And what would have been impossible in the 80s or 90s is suddenly tenable because, well, you know, the whole war on drugs is kind of grinding to a halt in different ways. I mean, for instance, you know, the U.S. is still kind of silly. I mean, Canada has just said, okay, look, it's legal to smoke weed. We're going to stop playing dumb games and harassing people. Whereas in the United States, it's still a Schedule I substance on a federal level. On a state level, though, you have state laws in direct conflict with federal laws, so it's legal to smoke weed in more than half the United States at this point, either through medical use or just flat-out recreational. And P.S., you can buy and sell Tilray stocks on NASDAQ, which is equivalent to saying you can buy stock in Heroin Incorporated, because, you know, that's the same schedule that weed is still in. So it's just... what the fuck is that? It's theater of the absurd. It makes absolutely no sense. The drug laws of the United States and many countries are just silly. Well, that's one of the tragedies, and perhaps it's one of the things that can be examined in the narrative that's coming to light. I believe the United States has something like 4.4% of the world's population or thereabouts, and we have over 25% of the world's prison population, and a huge majority of people are in there for nonviolent drug-related offenses, and really, they don't need to be in there. It's, you know, arresting people for altering your state of consciousness against the government's wishes is pretty crazy. It's very close to a textbook definition of fascism. I mean, it's what is it that I'm doing? I'm attaching molecules to my receptors. So what the hell does that do to hurt anybody? It's all very weird.
Well, my question is, now that you're on the other side of this and that you're clean and you've moved past your time at MindVox and you had this mad decade, do you have any perspective on all this now?
the perspective was, I guess, that I don't like being bored, and I very much enjoyed my collection of different lives, and I sort of fell into, you know, this alternate world at the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami, and the Ibogaine Research Project, which has kind of continued to date, and working with psychedelic drugs and working with different technologies. I don't regret any parts of my life. I mean, I think I'm very blessed to have had a very interesting and colorful collection of lives. And if I look back, I mean, do I regret that I didn't, you know, sit on my ass in front of a computer in an office for 25 years instead? No. It would be cool if, you know, MindVox had not completely self-destructed. That, you know, that's one revelation, and it's, you know, perpetually something that Bruce and I are considering putting back online. It would be interesting to have done things differently, but then I would not have had the same experiences I've had to date. And I think that all experience is sacred. I think that we're all here for our own reasons. And I'm very grateful to have had the life that I've had so far. And, you know, you mentioned the whole backdrop of what's happening on planet Earth. And I think that's fucking phenomenal. I mean, it's on one part, you've got COVID, and there's all the questions around COVID. I mean, how much of that narrative is even real, and how much of it is just a narrative? And I won't go there because we've been talking a long time, and I want to derail it. But okay, so you got COVID, and then you've got a group of people, a strata of society, who can just coast indefinitely for months or years. It's like, okay, you're not making any money, or you can make money remotely, it doesn't matter. Then you've got this whole strata of society that, you know, whoops, everybody with the government seems to have forgotten about. It's like, okay, so you can't go to work, you're supposed to sit in your house and starve. You have extraordinary pressure building. And then on top of that, you drop this incident and all of it ignites. And it's like, okay, well, that's how revolutions begin. And I'm very hopeful that it's a peaceful and productive revolution, and that appears to be the direction it's headed in. So change is perpetual. And I think we're going through a phase where there's going to be extraordinary change, and I think that's magnificent, and that's that could be something that sort of defines the internet. There's Twitter, there's Facebook, there's all these different entities and their responses to it, and there is the ability to communicate. I mean, that's enormous. I mean, everyone has a phone. Everyone can shoot what the police are actually doing. Everyone, there's reality checks. And you know, I hope all of it takes us to a better place.
Yeah, that reminds me. I'm not a fan of Lenin, but he has a good quote where he said once that there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happens. Or decades happen, and it kind of feels like we're in the midst of that right now.
That's brilliant. I think it's a very apt quote for right now. It has been a pleasure to speak with you and wander through all these different decades of time, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to explore my thoughts kind of and share them.
Yeah, absolutely, my pleasure. And if you ever want to come back on again sometime, you got an open invitation.
Thanks very much. I'll take you up on that. I enjoyed our talk, and I'm sure we can find more things to ramble about in the future. And for right now, I wish you well, and I hope that the experiment in progress in America and worldwide turns out well. All right, peace.
Yep, take care.
All right, thank you to Patrick Kraupa, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Yammy. See you next time.